It's time for Twig This Week in Google. What a great conversation we're about to have about privacy, Google, cookies, iOS, and what it means to be a good netizen with Rebecca McKinnon, author of the brand new book called Consent of the Network. It's all coming up next on Twig. Stay here.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 135, recorded February 22nd, 2012. I Dream of Jarvis. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ford, featuring the EcoBoost engine with turbocharger and direct injection. Look for EcoBoost on the 2012 Explorer and Edge, the 2013 Escape, and at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, the show that covers Google. Oh boy, is there a lot to talk about this week. But also other services like Facebook and Twitter, the cloud. It's not social media, it's whatever Jeff and Gina want to talk about is really what it is. Jeff Jarvis is here. He is, of course, professor of journalism at the City University of New York and the author of Public Parts, a fabulous book all about life in public. Great to have you.
Always wonderful. Gina, highlight of the week.
Highlight of my week, too. Gina Trapani is also here from smarterware.org, and she's the author of Think Up App. Steve Martin's going to join us, one of your customers. Later today, 4 o'clock.
Is that today?
Yeah.
Today.
Excellent.
Well, and he used, and the reason it's relevant is that he contacted me about how do I save my tweets? I might want to write a book. And I said, I know who could do it. Gina Trapani. You said you hooked him up with ThinkUp and he wrote the book. So I don't have a copy yet, but I'll have to ask, is there an acknowledgement? I'm sure there is to ThinkUp. Speaking of books, we have somebody that I'm very excited to talk to in with us as well. Rebecca McKinnon is a journalist and the author of a brand. Hello, Rebecca. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Also a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. She co-founded Global Voices, which is about the coolest thing in the world, and is the author of a brand new book called Consent of the Network. In fact, I think your ears must have been burning because we've been talking about you on this show for a couple of weeks now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, wow. you make some very relevant points. So welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks very much.
And in fact, this week is probably a good week to have Rebecca on because Google's in all sorts of doo-doo. In fact, they're now facing a class action lawsuit over the Safari cookie circumvention. Privacy is a subject, but this is not just about privacy. The subtitle is The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. It's a balancing act, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a situation now where our lives as citizens, not only, you know, our personal lives and our jobs and our businesses depend on the internet, but our politics increasingly depend on the internet. And the internet is primarily, you know, we're depending on these privately owned platforms and services to conduct our politics more and more. And so there's this issue of, how do we ensure that the internet evolves in a way that's really compatible with the kind of political values that we have and is compatible with the kind of rights that we believe we're entitled to and that people around the world are risking their lives to achieve every day? And how do we make sure that not only governments are, you know, respecting our rights when they're seeking to regulate the internet, but also that companies are thinking about how their various commercial choices and cool features and so on are going to affect people politically all over the world.
You have a unique perspective because for 9 or 10 years you were stationed in Beijing as a correspondent for CNN. The years the internet arose, 1992 to 2001.
That's right.
So that must have been a very interesting perspective. Were you following what was happening in the U.S. with the internet at the same time as you were in Beijing, or were you focused on China?
Well, I was covering China. I was, you know, we were responsible for covering China. I wasn't a tech reporter at all.
Right.
You know, so I read the news. So I, you know, as a consumer and a user of the internet, as it appeared, I was sort of aware generally, but not as an internet techie specialist person. But it was really interesting because the commercial internet showed up in China in 1995, and immediately the journalists there and a lot of diplomats and business people were like, wow, the Chinese Communist Party is never going to survive this thing. There's just no way. But the Chinese government has actually managed to adapt to the internet and also manage the internet, both through blocking foreign sites and also basically controlling the domestic internet companies, to the extent that, yeah, people do feel freer to talk about a lot of things, but they still can't use the internet to organize an opposition party or to call for multi-party democracy without going to jail as usual. And so the fact that China is kind of exhibit A for how an authoritarian government can actually survive the internet is a cautionary tale and kind of poke some holes, I think, in some assumptions that some of us make about the nature of the internet and the relationship between the internet and politics and government.
Jeff and Gina, please don't let me hog this.
I'm a big fan of Rebecca's. I was privileged to be there in the meeting where Global Voices started, where she started it, and it was an amazing thing to watch at Harvard's Berkman Center going way back. And so I have immense respect for Rebecca on these topics, and I'm really glad that she wrote the book. At the end of mine, I too try to come around to say that we need principles to protect the internet. So, did you happen to see Robert McDowell's, I presume you did, op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today, the FCC commissioner, who warns of United Nations governments of the internet? And there's just so many players now who are under the guise of piracy, privacy, security, decency, or just simple power, are trying to step in and claim some sovereignty over the net. What was your thought about McDowell's piece?
Yeah, well, I read that piece, and I thought he raised a lot of really important points. And in fact, I have a chapter in the book dealing with these internet governance fights. And, you know, the internet, the standards and protocols of the internet and our addressing system and IP addressing system and so on are all managed by kind of multi-stakeholder organizations of different kinds. And ICANN, which manages the domain name system, is a nonprofit company based in San Diego, and the policy processes that they use are what we call multi-stakeholder. It involves industry and nonprofit groups and consultations with governments and all kinds of different people who have a stake and who also have expertise in how the internet should be developed. But there are a lot of governments who feel that these functions need to be taken under UN control. And the argument of China and Russia and quite a lot of other countries is that internet governance should be left to governments. And of course, when you're concerned about human rights and you're concerned about kind of the bureaucrats from various countries like China and Russia determining how our standards and protocols evolve, that's a big concern. So, you know, the argument being that when it comes to internet governance, it needs to stay multi-stakeholder. It needs to continue to involve not just governments, but the engineering committee, the engineering community and companies, the industry that actually develop the technologies, who actually understand the technology better than the government bureaucrats, and also civil society, you know, the people who actually use the internet for activism and need their rights to be protected. And a lot of governments aren't interested in those people's rights being protected. So we need kind of new ways of coordinating how the internet evolves to make sure that, you know, everybody who uses it is going to be able to use it in the manner that is really consistent with our universal rights.
Do we need new ways, or do we just need the present ways that have worked up to now not to be messed with?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define what's been working and what's not and so on. I think definitely with ICANN and with some of these organizations that coordinate protocols and standards, they tend to work pretty well. There are some issues with ICANN. The people who are kind of ICANN insiders will say that, you know, certain copyright industries have had too much say over how domain names are organized, or, you know, there's a lot of issues and questions about whether civil society, sort of the non non-governmental and non-commercial interests have enough say in these processes. But also the internet's changing, right? So it used to be that the businesses that were involved with really creating the internet and the engineers involved with developing protocols and standards were all in the West. And that has changed. Most of the development now with the internet, the growth is all in the developing world. It's all in the non-West. You have a lot of non-Western companies that are becoming increasingly powerful. You have Chinese companies that are more and more influential in bodies like the IETF, the engineering body that sets standards and protocols. And so things are internationalizing and getting more complicated. And there are more countries who are saying, well, you know, it's fine and good, you know, for these people in the West to say, oh, you know, the internet should be this way because it's good for people in the West, but it may or may not serve the needs of people in villages with slow bandwidth and other things. So there are some valid reasons why perhaps more voices and more, there needs to be more representation in coordinating the internet's development from the non-West and from the developing world. I think there's some legitimate arguments to be made there, but I don't think necessarily it's up to governments to take control either. So, you know, as the internet evolves, I think the things that worked when the internet was just kind of a Western thing may not work so well anyway as we evolve. So it is going to have to change in different ways, but I don't think a UN-style solution is the solution.
People in the chat room say, why do we have to get government involved at all?
Well, it's involved. It's been involved for a long time.
It's too late.
And you know, it's way, way too late. And the reason why it's involved is not just because it barged in there. It's because a lot of voters and internet users invited government in there because people say, oh, you know, I don't want my children to be, you know, accessing porn on the internet. Or people say, oh, you know, I need to have my networks protected from cybercrime. And so there, you know, we have invited regulation and invited legislation and invited government into the internet to help us solve a lot of problems that are, you know, serious problems that do need to be solved. But the problem is, how do you make sure that when the government is in there, that it's behaving accountably and not abusing its power? I mean, that's ultimately the issue. And part of the problem is even in democratic countries, you know, here in the U.S., we had a big fight over the Stop Online Piracy Act and, mm-hmm. you know, the whole question of how you deal with copyright infringement. And, it, you know, the problem is that you get legislators or Congress people who, you know, have constituents asking them to solve a problem and they grasp at a solution that ends up, you know, creating problems in other areas or infringing on people's rights in other ways. And so they're not kind of trying to think about, okay, how does this affect everybody who has a stake on the internet in all the different ways it might affect people? And so there's not, you know, it's and then you end up having mechanisms put in place, you know, for instance, fighting cybercrime. Oftentimes the solution that people grasp at is, oh, we need more surveillance. We need more government access to networks so that we can catch the bad guys. But, you know, that comes with a price, right? And so how do you hold accountable the abuse of power? How do you prevent the abuse of power as you're trying to solve these problems?
And unfortunately, it seems that instead of some sort of consensus between engineering interests, government interests, and we should mention commercial interests too. Tim Wu in the Master Switch kind of posits that there's no way we can maintain this as a open system because just with other previous open
That's
systems
right.
like long distance, commercial interests are just going to say, hey, okay, thanks very much. See y'all later. It's ours now. So you really have at least three parties, and if you include the public, I guess there's four parties who all have a vested interest, which all seem at odds with one another, to be frank.
Mm-hmm. Well, oftentimes they are. Sometimes,
how do you reach consensus?
Yeah, well, so, you know, look at how we do it kind of in a physical democracy. You don't really reach consensus. You just kind of balance off the
right.
interests.
Nobody's happy. Yeah.
Nobody's happy, but you kind of set up the system in such a way that as people pursue their self-interest, they're holding each other in check. so nobody can go too far without a backlash, you know, or that's how it's meant to be.
Right.
So I think, you know, that's likely to where it kind of goes. And you sometimes get alliances, like with the anti-SOPA stuff. You mm-hmm. saw industry and the human rights community joining forces against the legislation, which was fascinating. And so, I think we need to find a way to kind of have a balance of power in a way.
But the title of your book is Consent of the Networked. And really, we are, as the public, we are the ones who have the most at risk, most to gain, unfortunately have the least, not only authority, but least understanding of what the issues are.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if we gain more understanding and we start thinking about these digital spaces that we're spending growing amounts of time in, these services that we're increasingly relying on, if we think of ourselves less as a user of these things, just sort of passive,
right.
And more sort of as I use the term netizen, sort of a citizen of these spaces, and think about, you know, what are the levers I can use, both as a consumer, as an investor, as a citizen, as a voter, how can I sort of exercise my concerns, voice my concerns, and exercise my rights, and push the people who do hold power in this digital realm to change what they're doing, or to modify what they're doing, and respect our rights, and to recognize it's in their long-term self-interest to do so. It's in the government's interest to respect our rights. Otherwise, they have no legitimacy in the long term, which is politically bad for them. And with companies, if they don't respect our rights over the long run and we totally distrust them, that's going to diminish the value of what they're trying to sell and what they're trying to do. And so I think in the long run, the legitimacy of the internet as a whole and the various actors on it, it does depend on behaving in a way that respects people. But they're only going to understand that if people make that clear,
right.
And impose costs when our rights aren't respected.
But there's not. Well, and by the way, we're talking to Rebecca MacKinnon. Her book is The Consent of the Networked, brand new from Basic Books. The website is it consentofthenetworked.com?
Correct.
So you can go there and find it. There it is. So you can find out more about that. Although, you know, you even have disputes among individuals over what we want from the internet. For instance, the European Union wants to pass this right to be forgotten legislation, which I'm sure not only do governments in Europe, but many people, particularly Germans, no, I'm just kidding. I'll get the email. Europe think this is a good thing, but it's technically ridiculous, and this is why this seems to be such a Gordian knot, to be honest.
Yeah, well, this is and this happens on a lot of issues. I mean, you get other constituencies in a number of democracies that are calling for censorship of the internet, right. To protect children from pornography, and they're demanding that their elected representatives do something, and so
that's why God created Lamar Smith.
I think people, there's part of it is that there just needs to be more nuanced public discussion about kind of how the internet works and what's possible and so on. And I think, maybe industry needs to kind of treat the concerns with respect, even if the solutions proposed might seem idiotic, because the concerns are real. And I think if those concerns are treated with respect, then
not mocked.
More likely to be trust.
Not mocked anyway.
Not mocked.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, I think one has to respect the fact that a person is freaked out by Google Earth showing what's in their backyard. You know,
Wait. Google doesn't do that. Google doesn't do that. So that's just the problem. It's that kind of presumption that causes this.
But I am going to defend. I'm going to defend Rebecca in the sense that we will not be able to reach consensus if we don't look to the other person and say, "Well, I understand your desire for privacy and why you might want to blur your building, but there does need to be some dialogue about how does that work?"
Yes, Leo. But you know, if you look at the basis of Vivian Reding's regulations in the EU, it's polls that say things like, "Are you concerned about your privacy?" Well, 100% should say they are. Of course I am. Everyone is, right? Without any real discussion of the harm.
Well, but I think that's our mission is to educate.
Yes.
There's a lot
yes.
of education needs to be done.
There's
right.
tons.
And you look at all these issues, you know, it's balances and it's trade-offs and how to negotiate that on a global network, you know, where the European regulations end up
right.
affecting people outside of Europe, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yes.
And so it's, you know, and why, how do we hold them accountable for affecting how our internet works? We don't really have kind of the way of approaching that can kind of bring us to a solution at the moment.
And your solution in I'm extrapolating, but correct me if I'm, is that by the last chapter of your book is building a netizen-centric internet. It is involvement. Involvement of us as netizens. We need to be good netizens. You also talk about utopianism versus reality. Because I think Jeff and I are utopians. we're like John Perry yeah. Barlow. We believe in, you know, power to the people, freedom of cyberspace.
Yeah, yeah. No,
you
I
too.
Mean, it's definitely, you have to start with awareness. You have to start with people being involved. And, you know, just to clarify my critique of utopianism, which is, I think, different than some other people's critique of utopianism, which I won't get into here, has to do with the fact that I started out my academic life studying the origins of the Chinese and the Soviet revolutions that were started by utopians.
Yep.
Who thought that, you know, you could change human nature and, you know, had, I think, overly unrealistic ideals about what could be changed. And the idealistic people got used by very evil people, and very bad things happened. So I just tend to feel that, look, you know, the internet and what's going on the internet is an extension of human nature. Human beings are pretty screwed up lot. And I don't think that the internet changes human nature. I think we need to work under the assumption that, you know,
agreed.
We remain human and different aspects of human nature get amplified on the internet in all kinds of interesting ways, some very positive and some very negative and some just delightful and some just strange. But given human nature and what it is, I just think we need to be realistic yes, there are many delightful and wonderful things that the internet empowers, but it also empowers another set of things that are kind of part of who we are as a society and as a species, and that's not going to be changed by technology. And so we need to kind of embrace reality and accept that absolute power corrupts absolutely as much in digital space as it does in physical space, and that it doesn't matter how enlightened a particular technology CEO might be or how idealistic or utopian certain programmers might be, they're going to mess up, they may abuse power, and we need to kind of construct a digital world that kind of defaults for the absolute certainty that bad things will happen
yeah.
and that we need to constrain that.
It's made the internet. It's made of people.
That's right.
Yeah.
yeah. It is made of people.
Go ahead, Gina, please.
I was going to say that, you know, certainly the solution is for everyone to get more involved and to take their role as a netizen more seriously. And I may be saying this just because I'm a web developer, but for me, like if I have to choose between the engineering community, the government, commercial interests, and the public, I expect the engineering community especially to step up and to explain to government how technology works and the public so we can have those more nuanced discussions.
Informed discussions. You're right, Gina.
Informed discussions. I like to see benign engineers, you know, kind of making a difference. I think code is some of the best kind of activism possible. You know, when you look at what Reddit did with SOPA, and when you look at things even like Scroogle or Focus on the User, I mean, these are people who have opinions and are expressing them through tools. And I think that's really important because the engineers are the ones that really understand how this stuff works. And the engineering community has to figure out how to communicate that well to the public and to the government so that these decisions can be informed. I mean, the problem is that you know, the culture of being an engineer, sort of growing up a nerd or a computer programmer, is that you view yourself as an outcast, as someone who, you know, is necessarily the most popular kid in school, perhaps. I really want to see that mythology change in the next couple of generations. It has to happen. I really want to see, you know, a president of the United States who used to be a software developer. Like, I really look forward to that day.
Wouldn't that be something?
It would
never happen. Okay, but yeah. just pointing that out, but go ahead.
I mean, certainly you need people who understand people as well as they understand code, and there's often a disconnect there. But
for our
audience at Twig, we have a lot of engineers, or at least just technology enthusiasts who understand how tech works more than the public, government, or even the guys in business suits who just care about, you know, next quarter's earnings. And mm-hmm. I want to see more of that.
And I would say, again, that's our mission. I mean, and mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we speak to enthusiasts who already probably have a pretty good idea. But that is really the mission of everything that I do, is we got to get people to understand technology, give them the facts, let them make their decisions, but make informed decisions. I would also guess that some of the issue is that the perfect is the enemy of the good. Engineers are purists, see things as black and white. And the SOPA discussion was a perfect example where people who are more political – like Nilay Patel said, well, we got to find a middle ground and then purists like me say, but there's, and Jeff say, there's no such thing as piracy. It's good for everybody. Screw it.
I think engineers aren't utopians, which we're accused of doing and we laugh about, but engineers are optimists because they basically try to, always find solutions to problems and believe there is a solution to a problem and that it can
Absolutely.
Be found. If we're smart enough and work hard enough on it.
But politics is messy. It is the art of consensus. It's the art of, just as you were saying, Rebecca, there isn't a perfect solution. It's the art of you give a little, I'll give a little. And that's something engineers may not be very good at.
And I think
engineers hack around.
Yeah.
And one of the other challenges, too, is increasingly these tools and platforms are being used by people in cultures and political contexts. And languages that the engineers, you know, here in the United States, developing certain platforms anyway, just can't kind of conceive of how that experience ends up interacting in a particular political or cultural context and what ends up meaning for people. Mm-hmm. And so this is where I think not only diversifying the community of engineers and bringing people kind of from the developing world and from the non-West into the engineering community is really important, so that the concerns and needs of you know, the world's fastest growing part of the internet can really be understood better, but also find ways to kind of consult with types of people who face risks and vulnerabilities that somebody sitting in Palo Alto just might never have been able to dream about.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Diversity is so important for that reason. Luckily, we have a global network that can help us.
Thank God, because Sand Hill Road is the opposite of
diverse. But so many of our tools are built and conceived in Palo Alto, California, which is a completely different
thing. We got to change that.
Yes, we absolutely do.
And I do think it is starting to change, and I see more and more. That's why I loved going to the web and seeing the vital startup community in Europe. And it's just now it's all over the world, and there are startups all over the world. And
immigration into here and investment out of here are both important.
Yep. Although I have to say, and you know, Rebecca, you speak Chinese and you have a unique perspective on China. The language barrier is really a significant wall between what's happening. And there is a ton of stuff happening in China.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the language barrier, the membrane is impermeable.
Yeah, well, that's what makes, you know, there's kind of a set of engineers and technical people who are bilingual, and those people, I think, are going to become really
huge.
Valuable.
Yeah, hugely valuable. You actually grew up part of your life in China, right?
Yeah, I spent a couple years of grade school in Beijing.
I envy you. And what a change you've seen in Beijing over 20 years. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, Beijing's unrecognizable from when I was a kid.
This is completely off topic, but I'm going to throw it anyway. By the way, the book. Let's give you a plug. Consent of the Network, Rebecca McKinnon. Everybody buy it. What is your sense of the – what role – you know, I was in Beijing a couple of years ago, and it blew me away. I was a Chinese studies major in college like you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I fell in love with China. No, I've forgotten all my Chinese. I fell in love with China, and when I went back – and I had never gone, and I went there for the first time – blew me away. And I actually said at the time, I have a feeling this is the Chinese century, not the you know, last century was the American century. This might be the Chinese century. And some people there said, nah, there's some structural issues. It may not be economic. What's your sense of the role China will play going forward globally?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to predict. I mean, obviously, they're already a major economic powerhouse. You know, when it comes to technology, you know, you've got Chinese networking companies like Huawei and ZTE and so on that are globally competitive with Cisco and other major multinationals. And so, you know, there's a lot going on. I think they're very smart and innovative people in China. I think the innovation is stifled somewhat by the system. There are a lot of things, particularly anything related to user-generated content. There's a real disincentive from doing anything new because you don't know how to control it, you know, and then you might get in trouble and get your business shut down. So you're better off just kind of cloning stuff that already exists elsewhere. So there's, you know, I think there are some issues with the nature of their political system that does kind of get in the way of the Chinese people being as great as they really could be. But, you know, certainly we're seeing in so many ways how, you know, it's that country is a player.
Do they recognize that? Do they realize that that their restrictive policies are holding them back economically? I think
well,
they do.
I certainly I know a lot of Chinese people who do feel that way. I know people, business people in China who feel that way. If they say that publicly, they're, you know, if a CEO of a Chinese company who says that to his friends goes out and says that to the New York Times,
yeah, that's different.
that's like, you know, right. Going to be problematic for him. So there's actually a lot of people who do recognize that, and there's even a lot of people in the government who, you know, if you talk to them privately, they'll say, yeah, you know, our system is, you know, ossified, and we do need to find some way to move it forward. But the problem is, like, how do you move from A to B without everything falling apart? And everybody in the system has so much at stake, and they don't want to lose their jobs, or they don't want to lose their business, or, you know, a lot of people have a lot to lose these days in China. And so they don't want to take too much risk of getting in trouble. So everybody's just sort of muddling along and just kind of making do with the system as it is. And nobody's kind of really, you know, I mean, I think if the business community in China really kind of stood up and said, you know, we're not going to take this anymore, this is lame, perhaps things might change. But they don't have the cojones to do that at this moment.
It's fascinating. We're going to take a break. Rebecca McKinnon is here. ConsentOfTheNetworked.com if you want to know more about her book, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. And it couldn't be more timely, really. I mean, with the Arab Spring last year, and it's just a fascinating world we're living in a very rapidly changing system. I do want to talk about Google and iOS. And Rebecca, if you would like to stick around and join us, it really is about privacy, so I think you might have something to say about it. It's an interesting debate. But before we do that, I want to talk also about Ford Motor Company, our sponsor. Ford, of course, is a 21st century car company, a global company, by all means, making amazing vehicles. And it's just really inspiring when I've had the chance to speak to people at Ford about what they're doing, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. It's kind of inspiring. Here's a company that sells in pretty much every country of the world. They manufacture everywhere. They're trying to create a system that benefits from economies of scale in markets that are very diverse all over the world. And they have done some amazing things. And it's technology that is taking this 20th century industrial power into the technological 21st century. It's very fascinating. You can find out more about the technology story at Ford.com/technology. One of the things you can't forget is, you know, we talk about electric cars. They're doing it. Hybrid electric. Diesel, but it's still, you know, it's still the as Alan Mulally calls it, the petrol car. I think we're the only country in the world that still calls it gasoline. The petrol engine, he calls it. And EcoBoost is, wow, fascinating solution to an interesting problem that might seem impossible. How do you give consumers what they want, which is big, powerful cars and big, powerful engines, and still get the fuel economy that not only do consumers want but government's mandate? And that's where the EcoBoost is quite interesting. I drove the 3.5-liter EcoBoost in the SHO, and I was blown away by the pickup, the torque, and yet the great gas mileage. They've got 2-liter EcoBoost engines now in the new 2012 Ford Explorer and the Ford Edge, getting 28 highway miles per gallon in that 2-liter engine. In a big utility vehicle, amazing. They do it with two technologies, direct injection, producing a cooler. I'm going to read this because I'm no automotive technologist. DI produces a cooler, denser charge that generates more power per drop of fuel. And then they use turbochargers. I know a little bit about that because we've had, you know, turbocharged engines for years. But traditionally, that single turbine takes a while to spin up. It spins up from the exhaust. And the turbine compresses the air going into the piston, which, again, gives you a much more efficient, powerful ride. But the spin-up is slow. It's a little hesitation. Not with these new Fords. They're using smaller dual turbochargers, engine-cooled turbochargers, to do the same work. So they spin up fast. There's virtually no lag. And you get incredible low-end torque and responsiveness. So I have to say, I'm just, you know, if you're interested in this stuff, and I know many of you are, go to Ford.com/technology. Learn about the technologies Ford is putting into its 21st century vehicles, including the new EcoBoost engines and the Ford Sync and the My Ford Touch. And it just goes on and on. And, of course, the gas-free engines, the electric vehicles. Ford.com/technology. And, you know, if you went to your Ford dealer, they might let you drive one today, the 2012 Explorer, the 2012 Edge, and the 2013 Escape coming in just a few months. Ford.com/technology. We thank them for their support of our show. So I do not know what to say about this thing. I have been myself. I've put my head into the turbine. My hair is a little shorter than it was.
I may be joining you there.
Well, good. I'd like to, you know, and we're seeing, I think you and I, Jeff, are sometimes seen as Google apologists. And I want to emphasize, I don't believe that I'm a Google apologist here, but I want to raise all the issues. And I think that the Wall Street Journal was perhaps a slightly slanted. It published an article based on work from a security researcher about what Google was doing, which was absolutely sneaky. I have, you know, they
sneaky.
It was sneaky. There's no question that it was. You agree? Sneaky.
Yes.
We're not denying the sneakiness thereof.
They were invisibly submitting a form, or they were posting a form in an invisible iframe in the background without telling you when you visited a website. Let's just be clear about what's happening.
That's pretty sneaky. Now,
yes.
The reason they were doing this, and this is where it gets to be a larger story, but I'm not going to deny that it was absolutely sneaky. It was wrong. I'm sure Google will not do it anymore. They said, and this is getting wearing a little thin, oh, we made a mistake. We just did it so that we could put +1 buttons on the ads. The reason they did it is because on iOS, Safari, by default, without telling the user, does something, it disables third-party cookies. In the Safari settings, there are three settings. This is on the desktop. Most browsers now do this. Chrome does do this. You have three choices: accept all cookies, accept no cookies. Of course, you accept no cookies. Cookies are those persistent state information settings, basically, that are saved on your hard drive. Accept no cookies, a lot of the web doesn't work. There is a middle ground, however, and this is what a Safari does by default, which is accept cookies, but only from the site that you were specifically visiting. So when you go to, let's say, the Wall Street Journal, only the Wall Street Journal can set cookies, not the 15 different ad services that they have on that site, which are attempting to set cookies from their domain. Why do they do that? Well, because they want to track you, what you look at, and try to serve you ads that are more targeted. It's also something Facebook has to do with the like button. Google has to do with the +1 button. You know, if you go to a site with a like button, a cookie may be set by that site, but the like button could also set a cookie as a third party unless it's disabled. Apple decided only on iOS, not on its desktop, to disable these third-party cookies. Some say, John Battelle specifically, and again, John has a dog in this hunt because he's the head of Federated Media.
An ad
servicing agency, but he points out that there may be reasons Apple set this policy on iOS that have nothing to do with privacy, despite the fact that that's what Apple says it's all about. But in fact, Apple, and I think this is pretty clear that this is Apple's intent anyway, all across the board, is if you're an Apple iOS user, you're an Apple customer, And the hell with anybody else who wants to find out anything about you. Apple keeps that information to itself. And we should point out, uses it to sell its own ads on iAds. So John's saying, a sad state of Internet affairs, the Journal on Google, Apple, and quote, privacy. There's no question that Journal got it wrong with the headline. There's no iPhone tracking going on here. That is not what's going on.
Yeah, that is the worst headline in the history of...
Yeah, and probably the case that Julia Angwin did not write the headline. Usually they have headline
writers. But the story, it's still the Journal's hysteria. It's the moral panic and hysteria that the Journal has brought to this entire topic from the beginning.
Now, I had Kara Swisher on Twitter, and I challenged her with that because she writes for All Things D, which is also a News Corp company. And she did work for the Journal. And she said, look, you got to understand that Julia, who writes these articles, is not driven by, that she's doing... She's exposing these things. And headline aside, I think there was nothing wrong in what she said in her article, right?
No, I'm going to disagree there because I think that it mischaracterizes what was happening. And I'll point to Lauren Weinstein's very good blog post on this. Let's get back to some non-hysterical basis of these, right? Cookies were invented, correct me if I'm wrong, Gina, but to set state, to understand from one request to the next what's happening here. And we can look at this in a lot of ways, right? One is that Apple, I think, is almost engaging in a form of antitrust by trying to cut off everybody else's advertising revenue in this, because you need this to be able to do it. I know I'm frozen. I'll
that's okay. It's a good look.
Turn off again. Yeah, I know. I'll turn off and turn on again. And so it always happens when I start a rant. It's Skype trying to tell me something. So a few things here. One is I want to stay signed into Google. And, I don't know that Apple is necessarily representing my desires. They changed, just like Facebook has been accused of doing, they changed a preference kind of in the background without telling me, that has an economic impact on media that I care about. That's an issue, too. Second, since the beginning of advertising, very, very soon after advertising began on the web, after Wired had the first ad long, long ago, General Motors insisted on serving its own ads and thus its own cookies. And that has been the standard of internet advertising since like 1997. It has been a constant, and it's not evil and it's not wrong. Third, I think we've got to get past this idea of calling anonymous cookies a privacy violation. If you don't know who I am, how can it be a privacy violation? And so what Lauren points out was that Google used a well-known, it wasn't even a hack. It was a door that was put there for a reason. And the problem with it was in an engineering sense, according to Lauren, is Apple's. That the door was meant to just, all Google intended to do was have its cookies stay there so that it keep you signed in. What happened with the way it was engineered with Apple was that it allowed other cookies and other things to be set that one would not have otherwise guessed. And so, I think there's in this entire story, there's what it's approaching a moral panic that I think has become rather ridiculous.
Well, by the way, I just learned something on our Security Now. We had quite a debate on this as well, because Steve Gibson, our security guy, does believe third-party cookies are a privacy violation. I think you should have the right to turn them off. And I'm glad that Apple has that setting. I don't think that that's – I have no problem with that. But here's an interesting point. I don't know if it's a data point, but interesting. WebKit, which, of course, both Chrome and Safari are based on – Gina, you'll vouch for this.
Yep.
That bug or hole or opening was fixed in WebKit months ago by Google. Apple did not adopt that patch on Safari yet. But it's been out for, I don't know how long, but months. My sense is it's been out for a long time.
So the ability to post to the iframe in the manner, the way that Google
is disabled in WebKit and Chrome.
Right. So the idea is if you have disabled third-party cookies, which Mobile Safari does by default.
It blocks
no other browser does by default. So there's a couple of issues here. And John Battelle says everybody in the world, every browser in the world by default allows third-party cookies. So the fact that Apple has changed this default setting in order so that they can say that Mobile Safari is more secure, right, so they can use it kind of as a PR thing, was wrong, that they shouldn't have done that. I have a little bit of a problem with that. I mean, I just, as a developer, it's Apple's decided to change a default setting. because they thought it was a better experience. I mean, the user, I mean, granted, most users don't change their default settings.
Most users have no clue what third-party cookies are.
You know what?
Right.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Because I was thinking about this. I was thinking about this today.
And Rebecca, don't let these loudmouths keep you out of the conversation. Well, if you have anything
I'll
to throw
in. I'm ready.
And by these loudmouths, I mean me. Go ahead.
If we believe, so let's compare this to piracy. If we believe that a business, a content business, has the right to set its own business terms, which in the case of piracy is, I will charge you for content, and to violate that is a violation of their rights and is wrong, and by God, we should pass all kinds of laws around that. Well, the same count, a content business that is advertising supported sets a business term which says, I'm going to give you advertising. And to give you advertising that is of value to me, I need to set cookies. And if you turn that off, which even though the entire web enables that capability, if you turn that off, why aren't you robbing value from me the same way up? Damn pirate is.
Well, wait a second. When you say the entire web enables it, you're saying that most browsers have that chip by default allow third-party cookie. My question is, why doesn't Google, because it's doing this crazy JavaScript to submit this form in the background, why doesn't it just pop an alert that say, hey.
That's what they should have done.
Allow Google cookies? Okay, cancel. You know what I mean? Like, that's what's sneaky about it, is that they were doing this thing in the background. Hell.
Well, that's the argument against it.
We had last year, right? Yeah. Is it?
I think we have to go back to Apple. But what I'm saying, even without this specification,
I don't know. Actually, Gina, there may be a technical reason. Remember, Apple tightly controls this platform. It may not be possible for Google to re-enable that programmatically from the website. In fact, I guarantee you they can't. So what they would have to say is, by the way, you can't use the +1 button on iOS Safari. You need to go into settings, go into Safari. So that they couldn't do it themselves. You'd have to go through this thing. And I don't blame Google for not wanting to do that. I do blame them for sneaking through. Maybe they should have just put out a blog post saying, hey, we can't do this, just show you should know. But the other argument is it only happens if you're logged in, if you're logged into a Google account, right? It doesn't happen if you're not logged into Google.
Right, right. Let me just try that one last time. I don't want Gina to argue with me. That would be lovely. Forget the Google case. Just go with my economic argument here that says that if you violate the business terms of an advertising-supported service, why is that any different in economic terms than piracy is alleged to be? And why are we not having fits about that the same way we do? Now, in fact, the web is set up. Most browsers do let you turn off cookies. You can kill cookies. You can go to incognito windows. It does allow all those things, and I think it's fine that you have that capability. But there's no moral outrage about cutting off the economic support for the New York Times. There is a moral outrage with better lobbyists for cutting off the economic support to Warner Brothers.
Wow. So Jeff, I want to thank you for making
Jeff,
look more.
You might see the lobbyists going to Congress on this one next.
There is a point to be made, which is you are, in fact, cutting off their ability to monetize. They can still monetize without these third-party cookies. The ads are still seen. What it does is it reduces the amount of money they can make because they can't sell targeted ads.
I fast-forward through commercials on my TiVo, okay?
Gina.
TV that I pay for, and then I fast-forward through commercials.
We should make a law against that.
Well, we do in the case of piracy.
That's
don't
a closer metaphor.
Somebody probably tried.
Yeah. Actually, they did. In fact, there was a very good company. Was it Replay TV that got sued out of existence because they had a 30-second ad skip button on their remote?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this has come up. This is the thing. I just think that that's a closer analogy. I mean, I think there's a difference between BitTorrenting an HBO show and skipping through the commercials, when you're watching TV. You could argue that it's the same result, but they're different kind of levels here. So, I mean, disabling third-party cookies, opening up an incognito mode window in your browser, those things are not. You know, that they shouldn't be.
It's not piracy.
I agree. They should be fine. Where is the outrage from the media companies about that? Where is their support in Congress?
Because nobody. It's hard to get humans motivated to support ads. But the fact of the matter is, as unpleasant and unpalatable and as it is, we get a lot of free stuff on the internet. We get Google free. We get Facebook free. We get that stuff by pay. It's not really free. We pay for it with our attention. And I believe, and I know you do too, Jeff, we pay for it with demographic information about what we look about, behavioral information. Yep. And the problem is it's not so clear. People aren't really aware of this, so they can kind of not think about it. But the reason you get Gmail and Google Docs and all this stuff for free is because Google can monetize it using your attention and your demographic
And let's push the other presumption here that you said earlier that Apple decided that doing this was going to give you a better experience on the web. How is it better?
Yeah, I'm not clear that it's
better. What is Apple's real motivation here? Why did Apple make that setting? I think that's where Patel's right, that we haven't really probed that enough. And I'm not, you know...
I think you can make the case that Apple, which has done this in many other instances, wants to keep its customers to itself. They don't want Facebook to have that information. They don't want Google to have that information. You can clothe it in the garb of privacy. But you could also reasonably, as John does, interpret it as a commercial reason.
They don't want data going up for apps.
Right.
I can't believe I'm going to make the pure Apple argument here, but I'm going to do it just to be devil's advocate. it affects the speed of the page load, and it also is just Apple's general policy about native apps is right. You don't transmit information about the user without their consent back to the server.
Privacy by default is what you're
privacy
saying.
Privacy by default, yeah. Right, which is they would say is for a better user experience. Certainly speed is an issue. And again, I don't want to defend Apple here. Most likely it's a commercial interest. But those are possible.
It may not be. I think you could say, Apple could say, no, it's privacy by default. And that's
right.
How we do it throughout.
But that's not the real reason that they do other things.
Well, I don't think you. For instance, iAds, which Apple is an Apple company, and Apple advertising on third party apps that Apple sells. I'm sure they track you cross app. We don't know, but I'm sure they track you cross app.
Apple does plenty of things that are troubling. You know, the way in which they choose to censor apps. You know, there have been stories, I think, including in the Wall Street Journal, about the collection of people's movements. You know, that was sort of a bug on the phone. They've screwed up themselves. You know, on privacy and tracking on their devices. Yeah, you know, there's been all kinds. None of these companies have pure motives, and you know, some of them are kind of disingenuously. You know, you've also got Microsoft kind of. You know, trying to use Google's screw up to their advantage competitively and so on. But I think this points to a bigger problem, which is that which I think some of the news stories may kind of, as Jeff says, kind of overhype, but that people don't feel like they can trust what's going on. People are feeling increasingly distrustful of these services that we're now all kind of dependent on and that we want to use for all kinds of reasons. We don't want to disconnect from them. But at the same time, we feel creeped out half the time. And, you know, in some cases, there are people who have real concerns about how their information might get exposed or used by various authorities or various people seeking to do them harm. And so we need to, you know, how can we ensure that industry will do a better job of kind of making people feel reassured that their best interest is actually being thought about. And yes, we are making trade-offs using these services, but at the same time, trust is eroding. And if companies can't figure out a way to rebuild that trust, and I think the onus is partially on them, on the companies. There's a lack of trust, and if they don't work harder to build that trust, they're going to get regulated in all kinds of crazy ways that aren't
going to
be
Rebecca.
Good.
And they allowed cookies to be demonized, mystified and demonized, because they weren't transparent about, they weren't open about what they were doing, why they were doing it, and they asked for a lot of this trouble. The result, though, could hurt us all and hurt the internet and regulate the internet in ways that frighten me.
By the way,
the question is, where do we go from how do we move forward towards a good result?
Good. That's good. So and by the way, it was March 2010 that this bug was fixed everywhere but iOS. March 2010 is more than almost 2 years ago that this bug. It's a WebKit bug. I just posted in the chat the link. Lauren Weinstein actually put this in her post. This bug was fixed by everybody but Apple 2 years ago. So the question is, why was this not patched 2 years ago?
that's bad.
So I think that that is a little bit of a smoking gun. So I look at the only point that we have here. I know people are going to assume Jeff and I are Google apologists. That's not the point. The point is there is a more complicated, more nuanced discussion than the journal would have you think or any of the other tech blogs would have you think, because it really does make for great copy to say Google tracked iPhones. That is link bait. Yeah. But I think, Rebecca, you're absolutely right, and you're the cooler head prevailing here. Whatever side you come down on, the question is, what should policy be going forward? How do we avoid this happening again? Not who's at fault, who's sneaky, who's nice, but what? How do we handle this?
Yeah, how do we handle this? And is this for government to sort out, or do companies need to be?
God, I hope not.
Proactive,
right? I think we all hope government doesn't get involved in this.
I'm here in Washington, and I can tell you, there's people down the street on Capitol Hill just really wanting to get involved with this.
The FTC has already asked Google, "What the hell were you doing?"
There's all kinds of bills being proposed and so on, and so. But if industry doesn't want to get regulated, they've got to step up. They've got to prove that they can be trusted. And they are not providing particularly solid evidence in that regard. And so they've got to figure out how to interact with their users or constituents or whatever you want to call them to try and build trust.
Rebecca, I think you're absolutely right. And let me do an 80-20 rule on this. I think 80% of it is that they have to act far better, be more transparent, be more open. Just think this way in general. I've used the example before that people don't complain about Gmail priority inbox because they get value out of it. They've got to think about value. But the other 20%, I think, is they do have to start fighting back when they see things like these headlines and say, whoa, that's not true. Here's what's really going on. And you said before, don't mock. I would agree about not mocking the consumer's concerns, but one should mock bad headlines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is such an interesting story, and it's going to resonate, and it's not. And unfortunately, for Google, if you're Google, not unfortunately for anybody else, but unfortunately for Google, if you're Google, this is just one more piece of mud on the. I mean, they're buried by this stuff. They don't respond well. There was apparently debate internally about should we make a video explaining this, and they said no, nobody will understand it anyway.
It's the Arrington. It's the dog with your belly up.
Yeah.
Okay. Forgive me, even if what you did wasn't wrong. But again, Rebecca's still absolutely right. What they've been wrong about, and it's not just technology companies.
They
it's also
take
very
the bull
much
by the horns.
Media companies and advertising companies
have just been
terribly mysterious about this. And that's what does, I'm going to use the word, creep people out. Because they don't know what's going on. So, radical transparency, radically thinking truly about the consumers, the customers' desires and serving them is the only way to start digging yourself out for real. It's not messaging.
And if it's not enough just to say, well, we owe this to our customers, there should be motivation in the idea that if you don't, government will, and they'll screw it up mercilessly.
Boy, will they ever.
Yeah. And it's also, you can almost make a kind of a sustainability argument. If you want the web to be as valuable as possible for everybody who's using it and doing business on it. And if you want it to be a place that people want to be, you have to kind of take responsibility for it developing in a manner that, to continue the creepy meme, doesn't creep people out.
Right.
Right.
Google has to be a netizen just as much as we have to be netizens. We all need to be netizens. And at some point, the excuse that, well, this is new territory, we're all learning, doesn't hold water anymore. And I think now is the time. Okay, that's it. No more free passes. If an app developer, if Facebook, Microsoft, Google, or Apple, or Amazon was unclear up to this point that people really care about this stuff, guess what? They do. No more excuses. Oh, Josh, we never thought about that. It's not going to hold water in the future. All right, moving on. Google to sell.
That's it.
I'm done.
Leaves. That's it.
That's it. Where's my gavel?
That's it. We're done.
Well, we could. You know what? You could go on for hours, and we have. I mean, this discussion. If you want more, folks, and I know you don't, but if you did, Security Now earlier today, This Week in Tech on Sunday, this was the absolute topic of discussion. And thank God, Jeff Jarvis has made me look like a moderate. By saying it's akin to piracy what Apple's doing. Thank you, Jeff. Because up to now, I was all alone on this hill. Jeff's the one in the red shirt, kids.
I'll take bullets for you, boss.
Google's going to sell heads-up display glasses by year's end. I do not know why Nick Bilton wrote this article, but he did. I don't know who will buy this, but I guess they will. According to sources at Google familiar with the project, $250 to $600 for glasses that look like those Oakley Thumps. They were sunglasses that had earbuds. Apparently, if you have an Android phone, you'll have a heads-up display on your glasses that will show you crap.
Do you not want this? Am I the only one here that wants this? Come on.
Oh, I want this. Oh, absolutely.
Google I.O. giveaway, baby.
The glasses. Really? You want this? The glasses will have a low res. So this, we're all going to Google I.O. That's all right. The glasses will have a low resolution built-in camera that will monitor the world in real time. It's augmented reality and overlay information about locations, surrounding buildings, and friends who might be nearby. You know what this reminds me of? I don't know if you've read Daniel Suarez's book, Demon. And
that's exactly what I was going to say.
So in that world, you could see a metaverse that was superimposed on the real universe, and it was like games. People would have their reputation score floating in bubbles over their head.
And they had self-driving cars.
Yeah. So I think, obviously, Larry Page is a big Daniel Suarez fan.
So with these glasses on, if I look at you, Leo, am I going to see the number of circles you're in kind of above your head?
Damn straight.
and in Suarez's novel, too, it was like you could see people's approval ratings, their popularity ratings, and, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's about reputation. It's like gaming where you have hit points, experience points, all of that stuff. You actually have levels. I think you could level up, as I remember.
Yeah.
The project is currently being built, according to Nick. Nick has really been on it lately. In the Google X offices, a secret lab near Google's main campus that is charged with working on robots, space elevators, and dozens of other futuristic projects. Steve Lee, who created Latitude, is involved. Sergey Brin is spending most of his time in the X labs.
I love the idea that there are multiple space elevators being worked on.
Oh, that's right. It's plural.
Yes, it's plural. You know, all those space elevators.
There's different ways to do it. The glasses will send data to the cloud and use things like... Well, if you think about it, this is what Eric Schmidt was talking about when you with your the pants analogy, right? This is more of that. They just want you to... They want to... But think of the privacy implications with the phrase, the glasses will send data to the cloud. Now Google will know not only where you are, but what you're looking at.
What you're looking at. Google goggles. It'll keep Twig in business for a long time.
And Apple will probably say somehow have a way to avoid you using this somehow. Block it. We have the Apple glasses that you put over the Google glasses.
Well, okay, wait. What would Apple glasses do? Apple glasses would just show you the things that Apple will sell to you.
No, they would only Jeff, they would only show you things that are beautiful.
That's
only
right.
Things with
that's
rounded
right.
corners.
Yes.
Anything with hard corners.
We will take square corners and round them.
Right. It automatically rounds corners.
You will live in a world of beautiful design.
Well, it gives everything like the highlight effect.
The world.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, I'd buy those. All right. It's such a goofy story. But it's Nick Bilton in the New York Times.
It's Nick Bilton.
It's Nick Bilton. How could it be false?
I say June Google I.O. We're all going to be walking around. That place.
That would be a sight.
Walking around bumping into each other because you won't be able to see anything.
Wouldn't that be a sight?
This is my hope.
It's like bumper geek bumper cars wearing these things.
It's definitely a way to get press. I could just see the front page of the New York Times with all us geeks walking around. So have you played with the new Latitude? Google's going after Foursquare, I guess. Yeah. So Latitude has always been the automatic check-in. It knows exactly where I go, right? And you can't see this. Only I can see this, but I'm now showing the world that I have traveled 74,577 miles, which is apparently a third of the way to the moon. Now, I just want everybody to note this, 74 hours at work last week.
Oh.
Despite the fact that my average is 29.
Did I buy stock in that company?
12 hours out, countries visited, airplane trips, my trips. But that's not the interesting thing. There's also a leaderboard now. These are all my check-ins. I guess the leaderboard's only on the is it only on the phone? And maybe it is.
Well, apparently you're in the lead.
I am in the lead. There it is. That's the Engadget screenshot that puts me number one. But that, I think I have 5 points. I don't think that counts.
I think it's just because it's new, right?
I guess. And I don't think that's like a global leader. I don't know. I don't even know that guy, Terrence O'Brien. I don't know why I'm on his list. But anyway, there you go. And this is a little creepy. This is, and I guess, again, only I can see this. This is today. Let's go to yesterday. These are all the places I visited. And you can go hour by hour through your travels.
So can you blacklist some places? Can you be like, when I go to the,
I don't think you can blacklist, but you can delete. My visits to the porn shop, you can delete, but I don't know if you can block.
You know, I got to say, after spending 9 years in China living under pretty heavy surveillance, I just cannot bring myself to use Foursquare or Google Latitude. Right? I just have this thing about not wanting people to know where I am.
It's okay. It's just Google. It's not the government.
So it didn't make you more comfortable. It made you less comfortable.
Being under surveillance all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, that's.
You don't feel safer.
It's definitely an uncomfortable experience.
Were there guys in cars and stuff that, like, you would look at that?
Well,
my minders.
There was a bit of that, you know, but my phone conversations were bugged, my apartment was bugged, my office was bugged. If you wanted to have a really private conversation, you leave your phone behind and go for a walk in the woods or something.
And you did that for a decade.
Yeah, and now soon we're going to have to leave our glasses behind, too.
When I visited China for the first time, a few months back, and I was just the cameras and having to hand over your ID in order to do anything, to check in the hotel, like ride the subway or go anywhere. That was an interesting experience for me. It was my first time, and I understood that culturally, handing over your ID is just a part of what you do, and it's not that big a deal. So I wondered, if it became sort of less of an issue, but certainly where I traveled, to my knowledge, wasn't, the rooms weren't bugged and my phone wasn't bugged. So that's just why.
Well, that's to your knowledge.
Yeah. Well, to my knowledge.
You were probably staying in nice tourist hotels though.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So I don't know. Maybe.
One of the big hotels in Beijing is actually, one of the hotels in Beijing is actually owned by the security services. One of the big.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And, I'm told that's, if you want a prostitute, that's the place to go. Seriously.
That is often true.
Yeah.
There's a report this week that The Guardian is looking at starting a Guardian-branded hotel, which just struck me as it was like Faulty Towers.
I don't know. I guess, I think some of this is I've so browbeaten by all this that I don't care anymore. It's like, go ahead, follow me around. What are they going to get?
Yeah. Well, I think that's how most people feel. But, this is the thing. There are always some people for whom it's really non-trivial and really serious.
Those people should log out of Google.
Yeah, but, so let's take for an example.
They should use burner phones.
So let's say you are... just to take an example, a victim of spousal abuse.
Right.
And you're involved with sort of political activities to try and get the law to protect people against spousal abuse better or something like that. And so in order to conduct your activism and communicate, you need to use these services because that's where people are. But, at the same time, you want your privacy protected, and you have really good reason to want your privacy protected. Or you're living in a country where, your political activity could be putting your life at risk. And, there are a lot of places where that's the case. And I think a lot of times the concern for privacy may not necessarily be for the sake of the majority, because I think the majority of people in any given country probably don't care that much, or may feel like it doesn't matter. But, you know, if people who are unpopular, people who are physically vulnerable, people who have peaceful yet, you know, kind of strange ideas that make others uncomfortable, if they have nowhere to go, unless they're engineers or programmers or geeks, you know, if you're just an ordinary person who uses technology about the normal level, and you don't have technical skills, if you're not able to kind of participate, that's a real problem.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. I completely agree. And that's something to be very aware of. And the point, and I guess the point, and we'll sum up the conversation this way, is you deserve a choice. Mm-hmm. But you do have a choice. I guess the issue is the internet, and this was an interesting conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, a human right? And if it is, then you then, you know, and I think increasingly it's, if not a right, it's a need, then you should have the right to participate on the internet without being tracked if that's your desire.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly you can't apply for a job.
Right.
You know, there are some communities where they're shutting down post offices, and if you don't have the internet, you know, your ability to communicate with the world is getting constrained. And so yeah, there.
But I think track is the wrong way to put it, Leo, because that's the emotional.
But we do need meaningful choices, we need meaningful levels of access.
I agree completely.
I think what it comes down to, a different way to put it, is that. There are appropriate times and needs for anonymity and pseudonymity and some control over that. And you may not be able to use that everywhere. You know, you can't drive if you don't say who you are and prove that.
That's true.
And we agree with that. But for Rebecca's case, what you really need is a way to securely maintain your anonymity or under your pseudonym. And know that you're secure in that way. And if you're a whistleblower, if you're a vulnerable person and so on, there are needs for that. And there are other cases where that's not appropriate, where you have to say who you are, because otherwise you can't get a license or get a passport and so on.
Right.
These are norms we'll figure out.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to wrap things up with, because it's time for TNT, with Gina Trapani's tip of the week. Two tips today.
Well, yeah, two tips today. The first one is kind of... goes along with this conversation really well. March 1st, Google's new privacy policy consolidation goes into effect. And if you want to start with a clean slate, basically, if you've been tracking your web history, or if Google has been keeping track of your web history up until now, when the new privacy policy goes into effect on March 1st, it'll be retroactive. So Google will be able to use the data it's collected in your web history to inform ads and other suggestions in its other products. You want to start with a clean slate before the privacy policy consolidation. The EFF, actually, we should post this in the show notes. The EFF just walks through. You can go to google.com/history, sign into your Google account, and you can basically clean your web history up until now. Not saying you necessarily, and you can turn it off if you want.
It's basically three steps. I mean, go to google.com/history and then remove all web history.
Yep. I'm not saying that you should do this or that you should turn it off. Web history is actually really useful. I'm just saying that when this privacy policy consolidation goes into effect on March 1st, if you don't want Google to use all the data it's collected thus far and just want to start with a clean slate on that day, then clean out your web history.
There's your right to be forgotten. Google deserves to be commended a little bit for the fact that they do give you this. They give you a dashboard that lets you know what they know. They give you the ability to delete it. They give you the ability to extract your data from Google and move on, none of which Apple gives you. So, admittedly, Google was bad and wrong and sneaky, but they do give you the tools to get out.
It's true. And I think as long as companies communicate, what are they doing with this data? How are they collecting it? How do I clear mine out?
And they have a very good privacy policy, very clear privacy policy.
Mm-hmm. And now it's very clear and a lot more simple.
Yeah.
Second tip, Google Docs for Android. New update just came out today. You can see real-time collaboration. So there's a little video up.
Wow.
So if Jeff and Leo and I are all working on the Twig rundown for today of stories, I can see on my Android phone, you know, Jeff and Leo making changes to the spreadsheet or the document in real-time on my phone.
You know, that was happening. I didn't know why, but that was happening while I was working on the doc right now. I was looking at things. I saw these people in there modify. Wow, that's weird.
That is holy cow.
So the video is kind of cute. You can see that they're putting a best man is going to give his toast at the wedding, and he's got all of his friends
editing
and making suggestions on their phones. It's a good idea. I mean, the real-time collaboration has always been great in Google Docs, but the fact that you can see it on your phone is pretty incredible. The UI is pretty good, even for small screens. And so it just lets you get work done on the go.
I love that.
And it's Android only, I believe, right now.
Don't write a best man speech without it. That's a pretty good example.
Yeah, it was a good example. Of course, in reality, most of us use Google Docs to, you know,
write work.
Boring reports and write and do spreadsheets.
Real stuff, but, yeah. Jeff Jarvis, your number of the week.
I'll go with this one, 5. Mm. I was down this morning at Nike doing a big hoo-ha presentation. They were kind of acted as if it was their Apple product release. They released the Fuel Band, which went on sale last week, or went on sale today, which is like the Up and like the Fitbit and so on, but it's done in a Nike way. But the thing that they... Oh, man. I'm frozen.
Well, here's the Fuel Band. You can show
it. I'm not going to get my fuel points for moving around.
Did you get... Because I'm wearing Up, but this might work, which would be nice.
I'm supposed to get one tonight. Well, I'm be able to play with it tonight. But what they showed today was they also showed new shoes with 5 sensors in them.
Wow.
And it ties directly by Bluetooth to your phone, to your iPod, I mean your iPhone. And so they showed, for example, being able to take a video of you playing basketball and superimposing on that video how many fuel points you got, how fast you went, how high you jumped. They have people like Rafa Nadal doing workouts, and you can compare yourself with that workout. Then, of course, here's the cloud touch. You can put it into the cloud, and it becomes social, and you can compete with other people over a workout a day, a month, whatever. And, you know, their argument is that it makes workouts not be work and be more fun. It also creates an incredible amount of fascinating data here. And we can get into the privacy discussion, too. But they're going to have aggregated data about people's exercise that I think will be really interesting. So it's like Kinect. Somebody said on Twitter as I was tweeting it this morning, it's like Kinect, but you can actually take it outside.
Right, right. This is why I don't like this whole privacy discussion, because that's the kind of thing that kills this kind of innovation.
Yes.
And, you know, it's opt-out. As long as it's opt-out, you don't have to wear one.
You don't have to send it anywhere. You don't have to do anything. But, you know, oh, my God, Nike knows how fast I run. Well, let me tell you right now, Nike, that's very slowly.
I'll tell you. I'll give you that information.
I put air quotes around run when I go do it.
By the way.
So you and me both.
Look at the stuff.
I just trot.
This is a great video. You got to look at the stuff that that doesn't count in. Let's see if I can rewind it. I can't.
There are some really great clips here.
This is very funny. Stuff that doesn't count. The dude from the Big Lebowski sitting in his chair does not count. Very funny. Yeah, I love that. My tool is something I had never heard of, and then Trey Ratcliffe was here yesterday doing Twit Photo, and Trey is somehow magically wired into the Googleverse, and he's offering invites to something called Google Schemer. Had either of you heard of Google Schemer?
No.
I love Schemer.
Oh.
And I'm sorry that I didn't bring it up sooner. It's really cool.
Thanks for
really
cool. telling us.
I know. I'm sorry. I love aspirational things, especially social aspirational things. You know, it's like I really want to run a 5K, and then, you know, you can tell your friends. But I'll let you explain it. It's a really cool app.
Well, the only explanation I'm going to give is it's invite only. But somehow Trey seems to have an infinite number of invites at his website, stuckincustoms.com, because he's using it to get people to sign up for his photo walk, which is coming up on Sunday, with Tom Anderson, the guy who started MySpace, which is kind of cool. I met Tom yesterday. He's a pretty cool guy. He's kind of cool.
I tried to get him on the show before. Did he come
on? No, he's very private. He won't come on.
Very private. He started MySpace.
You know, do you know what he did before MySpace, by the way?
Sorry.
I know. It's pretty funny, isn't it?
He's a nice guy. And I'm his friend on
He's done. He doesn't want to. He's like, I don't want to be in public. I just want to be me. And I completely don't blame him. And he's worth, you know, a gajillion dollars. So he just could do whatever he wants. Before he did MySpace, I hope I'm not revealing a confidence. He did 2 things that I've done. He wrote chapters for John C. Dvorak's books. In fact, one that I wrote a chapter for. And he was an intern at Tech TV.
Oh, really? Wow.
He was an intern for 3 months for Internet Tonight. I knew him. I didn't know I knew him. He was he's, by the way, now, I think, officially the most successful Tech TV intern in history. And unlikely to be unseated.
Not just financially, but also outsporting Rupert Murdoch.
He sold MySpace before.
Take that, Rupert.
Yeah. Anyway, here's where you go. Go to stuckincustoms.com, LA photo walk entry, and right here there's a link that will actually give you an invite to Schemer. So Schemer is, first of all, it doesn't look like Google. It looks so cool. It's really neat. Mm-hmm. Gina, I just got it. What is it? Tell me what it does. I can sign up for events. I can say this is what I want to do.
Yeah, you can enter a scheme, say like, I want to learn Italian or I want to climb Mount Everest. So it's kind of like aspiration. It's like an aspirational to-do list, like a big kind of life list goal type thing.
Right.
And then you can see schemes that people from your Google circles have proposed. Like, you know, some of my friends have said that they want to write a book. They want to visit certain museums.
Right.
And so then you can say, hey, I want to do this too. And you can mark schemes as things that you've already done. So it's kind of like a social, you know, life list or kind of bucket list type thing. What I like about it is that they're kind of big goals and a lot of fun stuff. You can really tell a lot about people, and it's just fun to kind of browse around and say, oh, yeah, you know, I want to do that too. And then people can leave comments and that kind of thing.
Would you say there's functionality to it, or is it just fun?
I think it's fun in that it's a social app just sort of centered around the idea of like stuff that you want to do. And you can, you know, the language is like you inspire people. So if you add a scheme that a lot of people say they want to do, you can say, oh, hey, you've inspired 50 people to want to do this.
Right.
In fact, there's quite a few people who want to appear on Twit.
I noticed that. That's become a very popular thing is to
auction it off, Leo.
Yeah.
So you can see who's done it and who wants to do it. So if it's something that you want to do, you can talk to people and say, hey, how did you go about this? I want to take a hot air balloon ride. You know, where did you go? How was it? That kind of thing.
Bring home a steak from Shabs. I mean, it's some of this is weird.
Yeah,
visit
some of it
Google
is really
office,
weird.
I see.
Yeah,
but it's fun. It's fun and it's social and it's for me. It's like one of those things that you know you go to and you just kind of feel inspired. Like, oh yeah, this sounds really fun. I do want to do this. Oh, I didn't know that so and so you know is a pilot or you know that kind of thing or had you know filed a patent. Things that you would. You know,
next time your kid comes up to you says, "I'm bored," you say, "Log into Schemer." And find something to do.
Exactly.
There's a lot of options and a lot of inspiration.
It's way more fun than a to-do list app where it's like pick up the milk,
right.
Go to the dentist.
It
you
isn't
know,
that.
It's fun stuff.
Yeah, it's
right.
Just stuff you wanna do. I want to thank Rebecca McKinnon for being here. So great to have Rebecca. She talk about an inspiration. We've mentioned the book, which is brand new, Consent of the Networked. From Basic Books, but I also really want to give her props for globalvoicesonline.org, which is an amazing, it's kind of a journalism Wikipedia, global, it's a community of bloggers who report citizen media from around the world, and it is just brilliant, and it is so important, I think.
Well, I've got to say, too, the people working on that and the community around it is so inspiring.
I bet.
I just learned so much from them.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for having me on.
If you want to get the news disintermediated, direct from people who are living it, this is the place to go, globalvoicesonline.org.
Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. And get the book because this is inspiring, too. And I think it's homework. This is to do, too. This is homework.
But it's fun. I'm told by people who, you know, are not connected to me that they think it's an easy read.
Good.
It's not a slog.
No, it is. It's quite – because you load it with stories and anecdotes, which I think is the key to something like this. So there's a lot of examples of – and it really is fun. It is. It's a great read. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
Please come back. You were really great. Everybody in the chat room agrees. We want you coming back on the show.
Love to do that. Right. Thanks.
We do this show every Wednesday right after Security Now, which can, you know, it's usually 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time on twit.tv. UTC, that'd be 2100. But, you know, you don't have to watch live. It's fun to watch live, but if you can't, we make audio and video available for download absolutely free on our website, twit.tv, or just subscribe in iTunes or whatever podcast client you use, Downcaster on iOS or Listen on Android. And you'll get those shows automatically. And I think that's worth doing. Gina is, of course, blogging at smarterware.org, writing software all the time for expert labs, including ThinkUp app. Thank you so much for being here, Gina.
Great show.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
Jeff Jarvis makes me look moderate, and that's saying something. BuzzMachine.com is his blog, at Jeff Jarvis on Twitter, at Google Plus, of course. And he's the author of a great book, which you must read, called Public Parts. I was telling my psychiatrist about you today.
Whoa.
Expect a call.
Don't I look better than this guy?
Do you appear in your dreams?
I said, I live in public. Is that okay? Anyway, Jeff, thank you. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you all for being here. And we'll see you next Wednesday on Twig.